The Man in Line with Barry Redfern.
Good afternoon. This is The Man in Line, not with Andy Wynn today because he's not feeling too well. So get well soon, Andy. This is Barry Redfern standing in for him. And today, it's all about climate change as we welcome two guests with a special interest in the subject. A subject always bound to bring heated discussion. Are we doing too much or too little about climate change, and at what cost? Should we really be ditching gas boilers so early? Heat pumps, would you have one? And what about the cost of everything at a time when we're all having to tighten our belts? So, if you have any comment to make about climate change, call us on 66 1368, or you can text us on 166 177, or of course you can email studio@manxradio.com. So without further ado, let me introduce our guest today. Welcome, sitting right next to me is Paul Crane, MLC, a former teacher, I believe, aren't you, Paul, with interests including climate change and population. And by the way, he's a man you turn to for facts and figures. Going by a book he's compiled, I don't know if you can see that if you're looking at our webcams on Facebook and YouTube, but he's got an Isle of Man Population Atlas, and it's an information-packed tome. So we're looking forward to a lot of statistics and information from you today. Okay, and also sitting next to him is John Curtis, whose business and work has been for many years involved in the renewable energy sector and achieving net zero. Well, welcome both of you to the studio.
Thank you, Larry.
And lots to talk about, and no doubt we'll be hearing from our listeners as well. But if I could start with you first, Paul. Climate change, is this too much too soon, do you think?
Well, in terms of climate change, no, it's almost too little too late, really. Climate change is absolutely with us. The science is, well, the word that keeps appearing is unequivocal, when scientists are using it, means there aren't really two sides to the argument. And it's clear that what's happening is the oceans, the atmosphere, the land is warming at unprecedented rates. It's warming faster than would happen within any natural changes going on. It's unequivocally human-induced. There are already clear indications that vulnerable groups around the world are suffering. Environments and ecosystems are suffering. We have already done damage. It's absolutely vital that we pull ourselves back from this. The carbon we put into the atmosphere will stay there for another 1,000 years, so it's not going to be a quick fix. We've left this legacy of more extreme weather events for not just our children and grandchildren, but 40 generations on down the line. And we're still very late tackling it globally and in the Isle of Man.
So you're coming from the point of view that we have to do something, and it has to be fairly soon.
That's right.
Right. Okay. Well, let's bring in John Curtis here. What's your feeling on this?
First of all, thank you, Barry, for inviting me onto The Man in Line today. And I think we all wish Andy Wint a rapid return to the program. Yeah. So I'm here really speaking about the involvement of the business community on the island, an active member of the Chamber of Commerce. And there is a very active sustainability group, because climate change is going to impact individual citizens here, but also businesses who may very well in the future have to bear the brunt of the cost of any mitigation changes that will need to be done. What I'd like to do first of all, if I may, Barry, is just to remind the listeners that the Isle of Man at COP26 last year joined into the UK's representation in the Paris Agreement. This means that there is a binding, and in fact in the case of the UK, a legally binding requirement to reach net zero by the year 2050. We have no time to lose. Over the last 10 years or so, the Isle of Man's carbon footprint has been steadily increasing, whereas in the UK it's gone down by 40%. In fact, 95% or more of our energy needs on the island are provided through the burning of fossil fuels. This is a situation that needs to change. With respect to what has happened in the past, in 2012, the government entered into a consultation for a wind farm, and that project was dropped. In 2020, they looked at it again, and that project was dropped. As far as I'm aware, the Isle of Man is the only nation in the Western world that does not have a single wind turbine to contribute towards renewable energy. This is shocking, and it needs to be addressed.
OK, John. Well, I think you both set the scene there. And we welcome anyone who's got a viewpoint on this to call in. 66 1368, or you can text us on 166177 or email studio@manxradio.com. And indeed, we do have a caller already, and it's Bonzo joining us. Good afternoon, Bonzo.
Hi there. Yes, and hello there to your guest. Yeah, they were just discussing about wind farms and onshore and offshore wind. The first mention of putting up wind turbines on the island, guess when it was?
Please enlighten
us. You tell us.
Guess when it was? I dare say your guests may be able to tell you. But
John,
I'll
do you want to guess?
I'm afraid I don't. I know that there was a major attempt to go to a commercial wind farm in the year 2012. I'm not aware of any initiatives prior to that date.
Okay, Bonzo, okay, it's all yours.
Right. The first discussion of putting up wind turbines onshore on the island was Tynwald 1994. There was a budget for onshore wind turbines with the MEA in 2003 or 4, I think it was. But that budget, which I think was 15 million at the time, disappeared into various other bits after the MEA loan issues. Since then, of course, there have been the issues of offshore wind, and how we don't have any of that because, of course, we are not a member of the UK renewables market and its contract for difference regime. Now, I and others have been pushing for Isle of Man to be part of this for quite some time. And certainly throughout the tenure of Minister Boot and Richard Lowell over at DEFA, and very little was done. And I think if things were reviewed again on that, I think I would be prepared to bet that actually nothing was done at all. Now that DEFA are doing these things and Climate Change Transformation Board, you're talking about COP26, and all credit to Daphne Kane, who did a fantastic job at COP26 by actually getting hold of the real people who actually make things happen over in the UK, whatever they call the DTI now, it's the BEIS, I think it is, who run the contracts for difference and offshore renewables market, is actually trying to get us in so that Ørsted can actually activate their plans to build, and that then we can get that offshore seabed leasing revenue, because the seabed leasing revenue, forget Kroger, this is stuff that we could get now and which would bring us, well, on the Ørsted plan, you'd be talking about £100 million a year for 10 years.
So Bonzo, you're saying you're all for getting gas out and helping finances with that?
Because that is something that A, will take a while to do, B, is actually against, as far as I can see, the Climate Change Act that Tynwald passed, the start, against all recommendations. And the big problem is that the revenue from that Kroger spent a lot of time saying is absolutely marvellous and will fund everything, that's revenue that is covered by the FERSA agreement with UK. Now, do you think that the UK are going to allow us to, if there's billions of pounds coming out of anything, to have that? Are they going to allow the Manx to have cheap gas? Of course they're not. They're going to say, that's our money. And they will take it just as in the same way they renegotiated the VAT agreement in 2008, unilaterally, after 2008, sorry, unilaterally. The thing is about seabed leasing revenue, however, is because we own the seabed, that money would be ours. UK Treasury could not touch a penny of it.
So you should... I mean, actually, if I can just put something to you about the future bonds, what about the island becoming completely self-sufficient, not even drawing energy from the UK, but actually becoming an exporter? Do you think that might be doable?
Well, certainly from the offshore wind farm, that would be very much doable, and that would be what they would be doing with it. They could supply our needs, which probably will go up to about 200 megawatts with transition from fossil fuels in heating and transition to electric vehicles and such like, which will, of course, increase the demand for electricity. Actually, that demand could be actually fulfilled by onshore wind, and that could be 100 megawatts. I'm hearing about schemes that could provide 100 megawatts.
Right. Well, if I could just stop you there, Bonzo, I'd like to, because I'd like to put some of your points now to John here, particularly about onshore wind. Is that a possibility?
Well, as I mentioned before, Barry, everyone else has got them. You know, I mean, nobody wants the wind farm in our backyard, but there are areas of the Isle of Man which are perfectly suitable for onshore wind. I think there's a couple of important points here. There is a transition that needs to happen, but we need to show progress. And this is where I'm very anxious. It was mentioned on your news today that they're trying to attract people to relocate to the Isle of Man. Now, if the Isle of Man is not seen as a place that is making progress with the mitigation of climate change, why would those people want to come, especially young people? We're seeing a movement of people out of the island, not staying here. Again, at the moment, all of our energy is almost coming from fossil fuels. Even putting up one commercial wind farm onshore will show intent. And what we don't see at the moment is real intent.
So you're for putting wind turbines actually on the island?
Absolutely.
Would you like one next to you?
In fact, I attempted to put one up just to go off-grid myself, and I wasn't permitted planning permission. So the government really needs to think clearly about what are we going to do in the future. You know, if we can't generate solar power, wind power, if we can't do that as individual citizens, then or businesses can't put up a wind farm that might power their factory, for example, we face a very rocky road ahead.
Isn't that, I mean, wind turbines can be quite noisy, can't they?
Well, they are, you know, but there are places on the island which have very, very sparse population. In fact, I think that some of the farming community might very well welcome the revenue that comes from having those wind turbines on their land. Has anybody asked them? It's a question that perhaps, Paul, you might like to come in on this point.
I don't want to get bogged down in detail here and whether farmers have been asked and things like that. I'd like to get back to the sort of bigger picture. I agree with so much of what's been said. The Isle of Man has been very slow in moving forward. I'm not surprised at all to hear that 1994 is when there was first talk of putting up wind turbines, because that would be about the time that we began to see them appearing in parts of the UK and in the Irish Sea and so on. Yeah. So we are behind. Our emissions have risen. We've passed the Climate Change Bill, became an act. It got royal assent just in December, so we're not very far into this. There's a lot of work to be done. It's not so simple that, you stick up some wind turbines, because once you introduce intermittent renewables that are not running permanently into the network, it creates some resilience issues. So this has to be planned and taken forward. We are reaching a point where the gas power station that we have, the combined cycle gas station, is beginning to see the end of its time on the horizon, and money would be needed to be spent on that. It is going to be far better to move into renewables. The UK
has indicated that their network will be 95% low carbon, and that includes nuclear, of course, but 95% low carbon by 2030. And so the reports that the Isle of Man has had done on how we move forward on this have all suggested, the scenarios under the Arup report all suggested, that we have a second interconnector. And that is an area that's under exploration. The possibility of having wind turbines onshore and offshore are absolutely still there. The difficulty with the offshore version is that the scale of it would be such that we might only take one-tenth of its production and the rest would have to be exported. So you'd need permissions to get those routes in.
Okay. Well, let's just go back very quickly to Bonzo. Bonzo, in a nutshell, are you happy with that? Wind turbines onshore?
Well, I'm certainly happy with the idea of wind turbines offshore. As I say, if they're bringing us that kind of seabed leasing money, which we can then use to sort out the strengthening of the network and all the things about the just transition to green energy.
Okay. Well, many thanks for calling us, Bonzo. Thank you. And we've got some emails in already from Dick, who: I support trying to improve the planet, but there is a danger of rushing things unnecessarily. Joe Biden was against climate in 2020 when he stood for president. One of his first acts was to cancel the Keystone XL pipeline, which was bringing 860,000 gallons a day of crude sand oil from Canada. By stopping it for climate change, it cost 140,000 jobs, but Americans are still using cars, so the oil company had to buy crude oil from abroad. Well, I get your point, Dick. Let's just go to John on that. I mean, can cost jobs and it can cost a lot of money, can't it, climate change?
Yes, but by the same token, the introduction of renewables to the island offers many opportunities for employment. If major wind farms take a lot of construction workers, they'll bring workers to the island, some of whom may stay to service those wind farms. We have to make a change, and we've got to make a change. And again, I want to point out that this isn't just a flight of fancy. We have 28 years to meet a legally binding obligation.
Now, you talk about legally binding obligation, but the public weren't really exactly consulted on all this, were they? There seems to be a disconnect between politicians and the public.
I agree. And in fact, as a businessman, I'm particularly concerned about the apparent disconnect between the business community. I've been to several meetings, sustainability meetings at the Chamber of Commerce recently. The business community on the island is committed and wants to engage, wants to look at ways in which decarbonisation can take place. They know that sooner or later there's going to be a cost burden. There's going to be some form of taxation which is going to be needed to support these projects.
More tax?
Yeah, carbon taxes.
Really?
So, for example, in the future...
But surely, if I just stop you there, haven't we had enough of taxation? I mean, goodness, we're now facing fantastic inflation. You know, we're really having to tighten our belts, and you're saying we need more tax.
I didn't say we need it. I'm saying it's inevitable. So what will happen, for example, if you take the ferry to Liverpool, there'll probably be a surcharge on the crossing. If you take a flight, there'll be a surcharge because there is a carbon footprint associated with those journeys. At some point or other, there will be costs that will need to be met. The business community know this and they're prepared to engage with the government. Your original point was about the communication between the business community and the government. The Climate Transformation Team was set up to essentially provide a bridge between government and the general community, the business community, who employ all the residents of the island, after all. There is a disconnect there, and this needs to be addressed. And the recent departure of Richard Loll as the director has not helped this situation at all. We need proper engagement and regular meetings, because the policies that the Isle of Man enters into, for example, joining the Paris Agreement, those need to be resolved through interaction with businesses.
But don't you think the public have had enough of all this? I mean, you all went off to Glasgow, didn't you?
Well, I went myself. The only person who went from the business community, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, but not enough part of the official government.
We have a moral obligation, apart from any legal obligation that might exist. Yeah. We have a moral obligation of citizens of the world to do our part
to protect the world.
Yeah. Please let me finish. To protect the world and make it a livable place for the generations to come.
But,
and putting our heads in the sand and saying, well, we're not accepting it, it doesn't matter, our contribution is minuscule, which is what one of the previous guests on the Man in Line a few days ago said, it's minuscule. Who cares what happens on the Isle of Man? This is not true. The carbon footprint per capita of the people on the island is one of the highest in the Western world. This is not acceptable. We must do our part.
But some of those attending that get-together... flying in private jets. They weren't exactly setting a good example, were they?
No, I agree. But we have to start somewhere, and we have to do our part. There are many, many well-meaning people on the island and many well-meaning businesses who are prepared to engage with the government on this issue to try and do our part.
Right. OK. Well, we have another caller on the line. William. Good afternoon, William. Welcome to the Man in Line.
Good afternoon.
And what would you like to talk about on climate change?
Can anybody explain to me why we have a fixation with wind power when we've got beautiful tide races that will go up and down the east and west coast of the Isle of Man, please?
I think this is one for you, Paul.
Okay, thank you. The tidal range in the Isle of Man is good. It looks attractive, and one day it may well be able to generate electricity for us. But in the meantime, there's a lot of research needed, further development needed, a lot of cost involved with that. Why is there a fixation with wind? Well, we've got one of the most favourable wind regimes in the whole of Europe. So given the wind that we've got, which is pretty well all year round, it offers the best by far of the renewable alternatives available to us.
But there is a certain amount of tidal power around the island. I mean, there was the plans were submitted for three different areas around the island for tidal power. Plans in the north, I think, on the east and in the south.
Yeah. Plans have been submitted. I don't think they were sort of fully funded projects ready to go forward.
No.
So that the position we're in is we've got a better option available in terms of wind.
Yeah.
The time for tide may come, but
there
it's
are
not
some
here yet.
There are some successful projects, though, around the world and even around the British Isles. I mean, the Orkneys and Shetland.
That's right, that's true. A lot of money has been invested into that. Some of these are pilot and research projects. We are keeping a watching brief all the time on a number of areas, and technologies may change. But at this juncture, there isn't anybody advising us who's recommending that we're ready for moving to tides. Wind is absolutely here. It's tested. It's tried. Fully available. Easy to get manufactured. So it's the option of choice.
If I might just add to Paul's comment there, the tidal projects take a lot of investment. And they take a long time to develop. So, you know, you're looking at 15 to 20 years to put a tidal system in, whereas we can get onshore wind turbines going, I would think, generating electricity, renewable energy on the island within 5 years, I would say.
But isn't that also down to a political will to have tidal power? I mean, there have been businessmen. I mean, one spoke to me that he actually had one of these units ready to install.
One of the difficulties that we've had in the last 6 months that I've been on the Climate Change Transformation Board is the number of different ideas that are out there. So one developer would say, why aren't you using tidal? And the next one says, why aren't you using geothermal? And the next one has a different preference, a group looking at the gas, of course. And in terms of moving forward, we need to move forward with what's available now, what we can plan, put in place and take us forward. And we had some comments before from John about the business community is committed. I want to stress that government is committed. Indeed, the work that's been getting done over the last couple of months especially, I take my hat off to the Climate Transformation team and the amount of work that they're putting together, working on an action plan to go for these 5 years through to 2027. And the commitment that's there from the Council of Ministers, from the Climate Transformation team and the board, and from Manx Utilities, all working from the same hymn sheet as we work a way of taking us forward here. The commitment is there, and I'm sure we will be seeing changes once the climate plan goes through, which is perhaps October now. We will see changes following that.
OK, well, there you are, William. Tidal power.
Can we ask that the term tidal is painted up on the thinking board for your progress group so it doesn't get buried?
It's built into progress reports, I think. So, yes, thank you for that.
OK, thanks very much, William, for calling. Thank you. And let's move on to our next caller, which is Wilf. Good afternoon, Wilf. Is Wilf there? We'll try getting Wilf again in a moment. We have another gentleman, Graham Fox-Hume. Good afternoon, Graham.
Hello.
And of course, you're no stranger to the Man in Line. You've called before because you're interested in geothermal, aren't you?
Indeed, yes. I would talk about that in a minute. But for the time being, what I want to point out is that offshore wind farms are quite possibly illegal. The reason being, of course, that they decimate wildlife. They kill seagulls by the thousand. And seagulls are a protected species. So the operators and users of the thing may well be committing an offence by killing seagulls. That's about it. What more do you need?
OK, gentlemen, killing seabirds.
Well, yes, I suppose some seabirds do die with the wind farms. You know, is there any perfect system that can be used in the future? I mean, we have to take into account the needs and balances of the whole community and the whole ecosystem, the wildlife and everything else.
Well,
it's a valid point. It's well made. And
well, let's look at some of the other...
Needs to be considered, I suppose.
Let's look at some of the other possibilities then. As well as wind power, the previous gentleman mentioned tidal power. We've got solar energy. There are heat pumps. There's geothermal. There's nuclear. What about nuclear?
Well, I'm actually a proponent. I think it would be... you see, the problem that Paul referred to earlier on is base load. You can have renewables, but like today, they wouldn't be turning and they're not generating electricity. So we have to have another means of powering the community when the wind isn't blowing. Right. And some form of base load is really important. The base load that's provided on the island at the moment, of course, is from Paul Rose, from the gas turbines. With the gas turbine being phased out in 10 years' time, the problem of base load is really a significant problem for Manx Utilities, which needs to be addressed. And one of the routes for doing the base load would be some form of a small nuclear reactor, right, which I think at least should be considered by the government. Paul,
Graham,
I don't know if you comment on
sorry,
that.
Sorry, Paul.
It's a government issue, I suppose.
It would be. Nothing is ruled out of the table over these next 30 years because the changes in technology that will happen over that period of time will be considerable. Nuclear has been talked about. It's very expensive. We would need a very small unit here to give us just base load.
Okay.
It is not likely to be a preferred way forward, at least in the next plan, the five-year plan coming through later this year.
Okay, Graham, so we need a base load of some kind. And we very much appreciate your concern for the birds. Are you still there, Graham? He's gone. He's gone. Well, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll be back in just a moment.
The Man in Line with Barry Redfern.
And good afternoon if you've just joined us. You can call us on 661368 or text on 166177 or email studio@magsradio.com. Today we're talking about climate change. We've had a few emails in already. One person says offshore wind farms will close fishing grounds. And what effect do they have on marine life? Also, when these windmills reach the end of their life. I'll just see if I can go through one or two more. Gentlemen, as you drive around the island, houses of a certain age have chimneys, absolutely loads of them, which would have a fire underneath them burning not only coal, but literally anything that burns. How on earth is the island's carbon footprint worse now than it was through the ages? Smoke and mirrors. Pardon the pun, says Jay.
Okay, can I pick up on that? When we're talking about the carbon footprint has grown, we're looking back to 1990, the population increased from then. added another 10, 15,000 from that point. The number of cars on the road greatly increased. So, there have been changes. The amount of travelling we do has greatly increased. So there are changes. I think the big picture of this that I think we need to try and get a grip on are we've a number of changes that we have to make on our way towards this statutory net zero by 2050. And the first of those is decarbonising our electricity, because everything else depends on that. 34% of our emissions come from energy producing electricity. And then we have, when we've got decarbonised electricity, then we have to look at how buildings are heated and how transport is carried out. And you're adding in another 10-15% on those from these areas. So it's critical that we're taking these forwards. Perhaps the very first starting point has to be about fabric first and getting insulation right, getting mechanical ventilation in houses that will let air in, but will warm it and dry air coming in and so on. And these are the sort of changes that we need to be cracking on with if we're going to make up the ground that we are behind. And this is where, you know, I'm pleased to say that the climate transformation team working on this plan that'll come out in September, October time, that is a crucial series of steps that we have to take. And then we've got an interim target in place, which is about 45% reduction in emissions by 2035. We would like to do it sooner than that. Right. But this is where government is at, and this is what we have to work on. And as I say, everybody's committed through Manx Utilities, council of ministers, climate change, transformation groups and so on. This is what we're working towards.
Well, earlier we were talking about this disconnect between politicians and the public. I think there's a line here someone's just sent in which sums up that kind of attitude. It says, climate change, what a load of tribe. It's all a setup being pushed for all the wrong reasons, says Gary and Ramsey. So there you are. That's someone who doesn't believe in it all. But
well,
you have to persuade these people.
194 countries disagree. They've signed up to the Paris Agreement. The Isle of Man was one of the last to sign up, but I'm very pleased now that they have accepted this global responsibility. I think if it was all a scam, why would so many countries with all those citizens, at COP26, when I went there, there were a lot of young people who were speaking up for the younger generations to come. What is going to be done by the leaders of today to protect our future? So I respect his view, but he's wrong.
Right. Well, let's go to Julian now. Julian, one of our regular callers. So where's your stand on climate change, Julian?
Hi, Barry. Actually, I've got a question for either of the two gentlemen, actually. Who would you say are the two most qualified scientists on the International Panel on Climate Change?
Well, let me just remind everybody of our guests in the studio, first of all. We've got Paul Crane, MLC, and we've got John Curtis also, who's very interested in renewable energy. He has a company concerned with net zero. So who would like to take that?
I don't know any individual names, but there are not just two. There are thousands, and they are drawn from every country in the world, and they have a common consensus that climate change is happening and we need to do something now. And these countries have joined up, and they have made a commitment, and this commitment must be borne by everybody, the business community, the residents of the island, and the government acting on their behalf. There is no time to lose. We must act now.
Julian.
A chap that I find quite interesting is Roy Spencer. He, for many years now, has been running the Aqua Satellite, which looks at rain evaporation and the cycling of water in the atmosphere. He works for NASA out of the University of Alabama's Hamilton facility. He's recently had some Google funding pulled because, obviously, he's well-versed in looking down through the satellites at what's going on in the atmosphere at multiple layers. And his funding was pulled because he said that the actual overall climate temperature over the world is actually slightly down by 0.02 degrees Celsius. The other scientist that I kind of have an interest in is she's actually out of the University of Kiev in Ukraine, although she's now working at Nottingham University. She's a PhD astrophysics professor in radiative transfer of solar prominences, and she's very interested in how the sun influences the world. And they both cleave to the idea that we're about to go, or we are just going into, the EDDY, E-double-D-Y, minimum, which means things will probably get a lot colder. And this is a cycle that happens every 400 years or so. The last few have been called the Dalton, the Maunder, the Spora.
So, Julian, just stop you there.
You get a bit of an increase in temperature, and then everything drops very quickly. Have you had any kind of experience of the discussion on the other side? And also including, of course, Patrick Moore, the co-founder of Greenpeace, who has removed himself from the Green movement altogether as he finds them anti-human.
Let's just get John Curtis in on that.
Well, everybody who's ever been into a greenhouse in the garden knows that when the sun is shining, it gets very hot in there. And very humid as well. And we have what's called the greenhouse effect. The fundamental parameter that is being measured by scientists worldwide is the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. This is at a higher level than any period in history over the last few millions of years. There is a natural cycle of the Earth driven by various cycles of the orbit of the Earth, and the natural glaciation cycles have been going for the last few million years. And in fact, it is perfectly true that we were due to have a glaciation cycle. But the fundamental fact is the concentration of carbon dioxide, because of emissions into the atmosphere caused by anthropogenic changes, is higher than at any point, and is in fact at a level that was equivalent to what was called the Carboniferous era. This is a significant change, and it is unbalancing. We call it climate change. I think we've all stopped using climate warming because it's people have got quite anxious about that. Climate change is that something is happening. And we need a stable climate, we need a stable world, and the best way to do that is to try and return carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere back to where they were around the start of the Industrial Revolution.
So, Julian, we have to move on. So,
you mentioned greenhouses before. Why is it that commercial greenhouses try and double the CO2 in the air to try and double their yields then? Because that must be good for the plants if they're increasing their speed of growth.
These are well-tried arguments. I've read the book on the inconvenient facts, the science that Al Gore didn't want you to read. And this is one of those that comes up in there. And it is absolutely true that plants use carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is a plant food as it gets put. But once temperatures are topping 35, 36 degrees, the temperature causes the yield to fall. And that's what's happening with the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So it's not a case of the more carbon dioxide, the better. That's absolutely not science.
Right, gentlemen, I'm going to have to stop you there because we have a lot of calls and we do have to move on. Julian, thank you very much indeed. Do we still have Wilf? I think he's gone. We have so many calls. We do have to get to the lines now. Stephen Moore, I think, is our next caller. Stephen.
Good afternoon, gentlemen, and good afternoon, listeners. I wasn't really wanting to speak on this subject, but I thought I would when I heard the possibility of tax rises, and I thought, good gracious, am I living in a parallel universe? We've got food banks which are increasing. We've got people who can no longer afford energy because their wages do not match the charges. We've got food increases which are going to be coming down the line for all sorts of reasons. Possibly they are linked to climate change. But I often think on the island, we've got to really cut our cloth accordingly and do what we can according to the budget.
Right, Stephen. Let's put that to Paul. Oh, I see. Can we afford it?
Can I just point out that the comment about tax rises didn't come from the member of Tynwald on the panel today? It is unclear yet what the costs will be right through to 2050, because we've got six administrations to go through before we get there, and the technology is going to change. That much is certain. There will be costs, that's no doubt, and it's absolutely true that we are in this extraordinary period of cost of living crisis, as it's called. Government will have to be mindful of that as we take things forward, as we offer support with insulation and offer support with changing the forms of electricity generation and how houses are heated.
Right. Thank you very much, Paul, and to Stephen. We're going to move on now. Back in a moment. Manx Radio.
The Man in Line with Barry Redfern.
And today we're talking about climate change. Our guests are Paul Crane, MLC, and John Curtis, who's worked for many years in the renewable energy sector and achieving net zero. So we've got a couple more calls. Charlie, I think, is on the line. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, boy. When I was young and fit, afternoon, gentlemen. Oh, Paul, you know Charlie. I used to dive. I mean, I used to dive down the Spanish Head and Sleshic and round the Sound. And we used to have to keep clear of Kitland and that because there was between 6 and 9 race running through there. So what sort of tidal race do you need to run a water turbine?
John.
At one point.
Well, it's a very good tidal race here. It was about 10 metres, I think, the highest span that we get in the two times of the year. It's a very good tidal race, but you can't just stick a turbine in there. You've got to build barriers to keep the sea out while it's being constructed. It's very expensive. It gives me an opportunity actually to bring in the fact that private enterprise and businesses, and I came on the programme really to talk about business relationship with climate change. You know, private enterprise exists on the island. There are many wealthy individuals who can make a very healthy profit by investing in these renewable energy projects, whether it's wind turbines, which are expensive to put up, whether it's a tidal race, which is, as Paul has said, is a possibility in the future, but it's a very long-term plan. These will require considerable investment. Businesses invest to make a profit. Profits are to be made in the future. And government needs to work together with business to find the funding mechanism to deliver these renewable projects. To answer your caller, the tidal race is certainly very good and good enough for this type of project.
So you're in favour of tidal power, Charlie?
Yes, well, they've done it at Stanford Lock, didn't they? But that's got the fastest tidal race on the Irish Sea. But also, you mentioned about putting turbines on land. There are turbines on land now in the Alaman.
No commercial wind farms.
There's no commercial electricity going into the grid, I don't think, is there? Wind turbines?
You seem to know something more than we do, Johnny.
They must be invisible ones.
If you go from St Mark's toward Ballymore, on the first bend, you've got a T-section going up the back of Stony Mountain. Then after the car park, there's a footpath going through to the top of Alamoda. The farm on the left has a wind turbine between trees, and he's painted green. So it can't be seen unless you're looking actually at it.
A private turbine.
Oh my goodness, he's in trouble.
Oh dear.
Oh dear.
I think we'll stop that course of conversation at this point. Thank you. Thank you very much indeed, Charlie. And we'll move on now to Fred on the line. Hello, Fred. Good afternoon.
Hi, Barry. Nice to talk to you.
And you are, Fred, also a geothermal enthusiast.
Well, I'm a geothermal enthusiast, but I'm also very much in the climate change sceptic court because what has actually been governing the climate on Earth for the last 4 billion years has been the sun. And I believe it's still the sun primarily today, yet we've been fed that it's man that's doing it. There is actually no scientific proof whatsoever that man is even contributing to climate change. It's all models that can't be verified, and none of the predictions of the models over the last 30 years have actually come true. Like, where was the 17-foot increase in sea level? Now, a fact is that 3,000 years ago, according to a BBC documentary from the Museum of Natural History, East Anglia, Suffolk in particular, had a present-day southern European climate. Now, Suffolk must have been quite a lot warmer then than it is today. We all know that Romans were growing grapes in Northumberland, or what is present-day Northumberland. So 2,000 years ago, Northumberland must have been quite a lot warmer as today. We know the sea levels 800 years ago around the Isle of Man were a lot higher than they are today. And we know that because Harlech Castle, just over the water, was built 800 years ago and it was built on the water, on the sea. It has a boat landing. It's nowhere near the sea at the moment. And I'm just very sceptical that we're being bullied in by the climate change enthusiasts and the Greens into doing things that are actually not going to be beneficial for the future of the Earth or its population.
OK, Fred. I could see John Curtis shaking his head through some of that.
Well, once again, I want to come back to, you know, Ronald's Way. They have they're measuring the temperatures, they're measuring the carbon dioxide concentrations. The point I think when we talk about climate change, Barry, the point we have to make is we need stability. Whatever caused the current climate on Earth, it suits humanity very well, and any change that impacts the way in which we can live our lives, a very narrow range of comfort range of where we live, it threatens the very future of humanity. So Ronald's Way is measuring it. It's available online. The key parameter here is the carbon dioxide concentration, which is caused by the burning of fossil fuels.
Well, we're going to say goodbye to Fred because we're running out of time. Thank you very much, Fred. We appreciate your comment. In the last few moments we have, if I could just turn to Paul, how do you feel about that, about the weather and everything?
The issue, the question that's come up, and there are people who are climate change sceptics, climate change deniers, and they tend to have different sort of backgrounds. They recognise that the climate is changing, but it's not caused by people, or they recognise the climate change and think it's beneficial. The climate is changing, and the evidence for that has prompted 4,000 members of the International Panel on Climate Change to say it's unequivocal that it's changing. It's unequivocal that it's caused by human activity. We're tipping some very fine balances, and we've got a very serious problem to tackle.
Thank you very much indeed, gentlemen. Our thanks to Paul Crane, MLC there, and John Curtis for being our guests today. We've had a lot of messages today. Sorry we haven't been able to read out yours, but we do read them all afterwards. Thanks also to Howard Kane, taking my place the other side of the glass today, and Alex Brindy, studio producer. And Andy, if you're listening, get well soon. I'm Barry Redfern. Thank you for joining us.